Hello, my name's Lexi Roberts. This is my show, Disaster Zone. I'm the disaster, this is the zone. This week we're going to be talking to Dr. Paul Crumpley. He's an Emily Dickinson specialist. For you who don't know, that's someone who basically studies Emily Dickinson a lot. He knows everything about this woman, basically. So let's take it away.
Because I could not stop for death, kindly stop for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility.
So, do we know, don't laugh when you hear this question, do you know what hair color Emily Dickinson had? Because I've heard stories that it's red, and I've heard stories that it's not red, and indeed it's actually brown.
Both are true. It was a kind of a reddish brown hair. And I know that because in the Emily Dickinson Museum in Amherst, they have some of her hair. Wave in a locket, and it definitely has a reddish tint to it.
So, and then additional question, is that like a mourning locket? Because I know those were popular during the time, like mourning jewelry where you get like some hair from someone who died and like make it.
This is more like a friendship that you would give someone, like you might have a lock of your child's hair in a locket that you'd wear around your neck.
Okay, cool.
Or you'd have a lock of hair from a lover, you know, or your fiance or your husband or your wife. Hair did play a major role in mourning in the 19th century, if that's something that your morbid mind is interested in.
It is.
Because they made jewelry, actual jewelry out of hair. And it was important to people in the 19th century to not forget the dealer departed. The idea being that they would then stay in touch with that sense of grief, that sense of loss, and never feel that they were entirely separate from that person. And they wanted to maintain that bond because the belief was that they'd be reunited on the other side for eternity.
Yeah, it's intensely interesting, like the just history of mourning jewelry, because literally it was a bunch of wig makers who were like, oh dang, we don't make wigs anymore. We need to figure something out, my dudes. They came up with this idea and it took off.
Well, it was a big part of the 19th century, and it sure seems strange. But you can go online and you can get images of hair jewelry if that intrigues you.
Yeah, and it's super interesting because I don't mean to scare you, but it's coming back. People are actually doing it. They're reclaiming it.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, it's becoming a thing again.
Well, maybe we'll turn out to be the strange ones for thinking it odd. Features of the human anatomy ought to be viewed as objects of beauty.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Perfect. I have the next question, and then there's a sub question. So why did you choose Emily Dickinson? Like, what drew you to her?
It's a kind of an interesting Well, I don't know how interesting it is, but my mother was an English teacher. And I remember hearing about Emily Dickinson as a recluse who wrote about her interior life and was strikingly penetrating in her perceptions. And I grew up sort of thinking that she lived a secluded existence, sort of surrounded by doilies, and that she was a gentle creature who really didn't engage with the larger world, a kind of ethereal, spiritual being, and a kind of spinster. When I began to read her on my own, I saw her as a much fiercer presence, a poet with a deep, often sarcastic sense of humor, a turn of mind that was deeply philosophical, who did not shy away from any of the major questions of her or any time, and who was deeply and directly engaged with the world around her. And that just sort of opened my eyes in ways to a dimension of the poet that excited my curiosity. So I wanted to look further. And as I dove into Dickinson, I felt myself just going deeper and deeper and deeper and not reaching bottom. And it's been over 30 years. And I still haven't felt that I've touched bottom with Dickinson. And I think if you have that kind of encounter with a writer, then they've got you. Then you can see dedicating serious time to them. And that's what happened to me. Maybe that's the best I can say about that.
Yeah, awesome. So I know a lot of people on radio are not like me and a huge nerd in an English major, but can you describe to us briefly what an Emily Dickinson specialist is?
Well, an Emily Dickinson specialist is someone who has dedicated themselves to the study of Emily Dickinson as a primary academic preoccupation. So I have some additional expertise. I have expertise when it comes to American women writers. I have expertise when it comes to American poets and to poetry. But my area of specialization, the subject that has attracted my attention over a prolonged period of time, has been Emily Dickinson. And I have explored, to the extent possible, all of the prominent academic publications related to Dickinson, and developed my own questions about Dickinson and pursued those in depth.
Okay, and cool. Let me look at my questions again. So, I know you, I heard from Morgan, my friend, that you wrote a book on her use of dashes. Do you have anything to say about that?
Sure.
Like, I'm excited to hear your answer on this.
Well, dashes are, according to almost any grammar you might consult, the most flexible form of punctuation. I mean, physically, the way that they appear on the page, periods can be large or small, but they're always a period. Exclamation points can be big or small, but they're generally configured in the same relationship to what appears around them. Dickinson's dashes and the dash itself can take a multiple forms. So that literally, physically, the way the dash appears, you always have to decide what kind of dash you're going to use. you don't spend much time thinking about what kind of period you're going to use, what kind of question mark you're going to use, what kind of quotation mark you're going to use. But you always have to make a decision about the dash. And that gets to the function of the dash. I think the dash, it introduces choices into texts where they appear, choices that readers have to make. So that in Dickinson poems where the dash is the dominant form of punctuation, you have to, as a reader, become actively involved in determining where syntactical units begin and end, where the sentences are. She doesn't tell you. You have to enter into the text and you become a kind of collaborator. You become a kind of equal to the poet. And I think that's what she wants. She wants people to enter into the creative process with her. And I think that this is a very democratic way of writing. Instead of being the possessor of knowledge who then gives it to the reader, viewing the reader as a vessel, an empty vessel to be filled with that knowledge, she says, no, you have something to contribute to this process and I want us to relate to one another in a kind of conversation that can take place among equals. Most people who've written about dash refer to it as introducing disjunction. That is, the flow of the language is somehow broken, and it can be broken in a big way, and that could be replaced with an exclamation point. It could be broken in a rather minor way, as you might through the use of a comma. But those decisions are left up to us as readers. And it leads to, I think, a greater engagement with the text. It also a greater uncertainty. It's harder to figure out with Dickinson what her authorial intent might have been. And if you go into it far enough, you begin to think of authorial intent as secondary. You know, there was some intent, but you become more interested in doing what you think Dickinson wanted you to do, which is make sense of it for yourself. And that gets at sort of what I like to think of as Dickinson's status as a democratic writer. But it also helps to explain why Dickinson has continued to engage readers and why her popularity has expanded. So that there are multiple movies made about Emily Dickinson. There's even a television.
There's a TV series.
Yeah. So I think that way of Dickinson has of inviting us to enter into the text as joint creators gives the poetry a kind of life that each generation can discover for itself.
Awesome. So here's a fun question, and I'm very curious. If you were selected for the last lecture, and for those who don't know, the last lecture is a very prestigious sort of thing that one lecturer or one professor per, I believe, year or semester is chosen, and they give what would be their last lecture if like they drop dead or whatever afterwards. So what would your last lecture be called?
Boy, that is a surprisingly difficult question. I think that Dickinson would play into it. I would probably also want to include Mae Swenson and maybe even a little Jack London. I think I might talk about what makes literature vital. The titles, I would have to come up with a sexier title than I can imagine right now. If I focused really on poetry or poetics, I might talk about the truth that drives writers, poets, that truth being worth studying at this moment because right now, historically, we're trying to figure out what truth is, you know, and there are a lot of people, philosophers, postmodern philosophers, who deny the existence of what would be considered absolute truth. But I think that for artists, generally speaking, there is a truth. And that truth is that each moment we experience is unlike any other moment. That's something almost everybody can agree is a universal truth, but it's an incredibly crucial truth for artists, because dwelling on that particular truth gives rise to the expression of novelty or newness that's constantly emerging around us, and combating the human tendency to see the present moment in terms of the past, to approach the present moment with patterns, with expectations, with a set of assumptions that blind us to what's new. So I might come up with a title that has to do with unmasking the truth of the present. And that might be kind of a fun title to play with.
That would be fun.
Yeah, unmasking the present truth. Poetry and the writer's place in the world. Maybe I'd do something like that.
I would go to that lecture.
Okay, cool. At least I have an audience one.
Well, I'm just kind of disappointed. This is just a personal side note. I'm just kind of disappointed that the university doesn't choose more English lecturers for the last lecture. Like, I've been the one, and it was amazing. And I'm like, why can't we have more? But
well, I must give a plug for my colleague, Brian McCuskey, who gave a last lecture maybe 3 years ago now. And he was riveting, absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, that was, I still remember the title. It was Alice in Wonderland versus Sherlock Holmes. And I was amazed. I believe.
So was I.
Yeah, I believe all these lectures are recorded in the archives in the library. So like people can check them out.
Right.
Okay. So I hate to do this to you, but I found out recently lots of Dickinson's poems, because they have a common meter, iambic and tetrameter, I believe. So 3 feet and 4 feet, respectively.
Yeah.
They can be sung to popular songs like I Want to Give the World a Coke, the Pokemon theme song, and you mentioned some others. What are some of the other songs?
The Yellow Rose of Texas.
Okay.
The problem with that is that you can, because she works with ballad meter, common meter. So it's a meter that lends itself to many melodies. The problem is that if you start singing the poems to melodies, it's really hard to stop.
Yeah, it is. It is. I've been singing.
You kind of flatten out the poem, but it's fun nonetheless.
I've been singing all the poems I've been reading to the Pokemon theme song. It haunts me. So small challenge. Can you try singing one of the poems to any one of these songs?
Okay. I'm game. I'm willing to appear foolish. I'm not a great singer, so let me get that. You'll see evidence of that shortly. So one of Dickinson's most famous poems is I Dwell in Possibility. And so you can sing that to the tune of the Yellow Rose of Texas. And so, any Texans, please be forgiving.
I'll forgive you.
I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior of doors, of chambers as the cedars, impregnate goal of eye, and for an everlasting roof, the gambrels of the sky, of visitors the fairest for occupation this, the spreading wide my narrow hens, to gather paradise. There you go.
I very much enjoyed that. I have another question about her meter. So we know Dickinson was highly educated for her time, like highly, highly educated. So my question is, if she's doing this on purpose, because I full-hearted believe that she knows iambic pentameter, she's studied Shakespeare, she's taken notes. But if she's doing this on purpose, why? I know she's an experimental poet, but still, why would she never, ever, to my knowledge, maybe she did, write a sonnet?
Well, that's a good question. It's one I haven't really thought about. I think one of the reasons is that she was an American poet. She was an experimental poet. The main source for her meter would be the ballad tradition that's ancient, but also more current would be hymnody, the hymn tradition that she grew up with, that a lot of the hymns that she would have encountered in the Protestant church that she grew up in, that's probably the primary source for the melodies and the meters that informed her thinking. She didn't really have any wish to, I don't think, emulate the British romantics or you know, Sidney and Spenser, you know, the great poets of the Renaissance. Shakespeare, she was very, very influenced by, and of course, he was the great sonneteer in addition to the dramatist. So I think she felt her that her talents flowed more naturally into the ballad and hymn tradition than the sonnet tradition. But that's still her metrical line tended to be shorter than the pentameter line. She tended to work in tetrameter and trimeter.
So two and three
beat lines, yeah. Syllables, four, yeah. Six and eight syllable, 14er combinations. But you know, that's a good question. That's my speculation, that the sonnet was and the villanelle, those are very tight verse forms, and ballad meter and hymnody is much more open-ended and flexible, and she frequently violated that strict conformity even to those metrical patterns. And so my guess would be that she would have found the sonnet confining.
That makes sense. I see a lot of Shakespeare in Emily Dickinson, if that makes sense, but it's mostly, so Juliet and her Romeo, like that line in Shakespeare sticks with me because it just messes up the meter because its stupid name is Romeo. And that just messes up the meter. And that's where I feel like she's getting most of her stuff. Like, let's see how I can mess with these people.
Well, Shakespeare is a huge influence.
Yeah.
And the only greater influence or competing influence would be the Bible. And then she draws on the other writers that she admires. Emily Bronte, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, George Eliot. Those were huge influences. Robert Browning was important to her too, but the women, Eliot, Barrett Browning, she knew current American writers, contemporaries, also like Helen Hunt Jackson, but Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Emily Bronte were huge influences. Still not as great as Shakespeare or the Bible, but.
Yeah. So I have another question. I'm sorry to spring on this on you without notice, but I've, throughout reading Emily Dickinson, I've been noticing a lot of other poets, if that makes sense. Like I noticed Robert Frost, and I mean, I'm probably reaching very much, but with her grammar and style, it just reminds me of E.E. Cummings. Like,
yeah.
Do we know like how many contemporary, like super important poets she's influenced, or is it just innumerable?
It's hard to imagine a contemporary poet who has not been influenced by Dickens. Frost was, E.E. Cummings was, Mae Swenson was, Elizabeth Bishop was. One of the reasons for that is that she was one of the earliest canonical women poets. And her use of metaphor and her metrical play appealed to early 20th and mid 20th century critics and scholars in a big way. When she first appeared in print in 1890, she created an immediate sensation because she broke with the predictable verse forms of the day. And people welcomed the freshness that they associated with her more unruly approach to poetry. So there have been different reasons that the public and the critics have responded positively to her. Now we like her poetry in many ways because we're discovering how it engages with issues that we still confront in the world today. Like in class today, we were beginning to talk about her role as an eco-poet, a poet who's addressing problems we're now confronting in our human management of the environment. And before that, we'd be talking about her religious poems. And she writes about the major concerns that we all face in life, birth, belief, death, loss, discovery, all those kinds of things.
Cool. So, I have another question, just a quick follow-up. What do you mean by canonical poets?
Every age selects from among all the writers at its disposal those they consider most essential, those they view as having often withstood the test of time, whose work hasn't faded into obscurity, and who continue to influence the work of writers at our moment. And Dickinson was considered one of those. And the way that you can go back and see who's considered canonical, for instance, is to look at early anthologies. So Dickinson began to appear in literary anthologies that were used in universities and secondary schools very early after her first appearance. That's what I mean by being canonical.
Okay, cool. And then I just have some more questions. So as we're talking about Dickinson, we need to address that she was a shut-in and she didn't like go outside at all. So is there any like favorite Dickinson fact about her like shut-in lifestyle you love, or just something that surprised you when you learned it?
Well, I don't like the term shut-in, because that suggests disability.
Okay.
And she led a very reclusive lifestyle, but she still went outside. She roamed the property where her family home was, and she didn't really enter into a reclusive lifestyle until her mid to late 30s. Early on, she seemed very social. And there are letters, some that you've read that we've discussed in class, where she had a very busy social life and she was out late. She didn't get back in till 2 o'clock. And it seems like she'd had something to drink. Mm-hmm. Okay. So she had an active, she was referred to as the Belle of Amherst. But It looks like as she became more interested in developing her art as a poet, she withdrew more and more from society. And probably as that happened, whatever shyness might have been part of her personality, that grew. And it's possible that she developed a kind of neurotic fear of crowds or social gatherings. But there's another side to her life. In the when she was producing, in the most productive years, she was producing as many as 200 poems a year. Some estimates are even greater. But to produce poetry at that rate, and for it to be the kind of substantial poetry that Dickinson produced, requires a lot of time in isolation, a lot of private time. And we know that she did most of her writing in her bedroom. She would recite poems occasionally to family members or to her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert Dickinson. So I think for her, a degree of reclusion and privacy was essential to the practice of her art. She also had an extensive correspondence and was considered the primary correspondent for the family. Now, you asked about things I might have discovered about her life as a recluse. There are verified stories of how she became a kind of favorite with the neighborhood kids because they would gather beneath her window and she would lower baskets to them containing cakes, cookies, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that quickly gets you into the graces of the children.
Yeah, yeah. And she was known while she was alive as a poet, even though she didn't actively pursue publication in her life. Her poems were published without her permission, 10 of them in her lifetime. So there was, I mean, she was very private, but she wasn't, she was very much in the minds and the imaginations of the citizens of Amherst. She was aware she was that of her presence. Mabel Loomis Todd, who was a co-editor of the first couple editions of Dickinson's poems, more than just the first couple editions, was immediately aware of Emily and referred to her as she'd learned about her from other citizens of Amherst. She referred to as the myth of Amherst, who always wore white and wrote a marvelous poetry that was striking for its originality. So she had a reputation, you know, that's which is kind of odd. A person who would intentionally lead a reclusive hermetic life wouldn't at the same time publicize that life, you know, or develop, nurture a reputation as an eccentric, what you really wanted to do was basically disappear from public view. That clearly wasn't her intent.
Cool. So there are unsubstantiated theories. I will say that she was a bisexual woman because of her, we've talked about this, but I'm sure many people aren't aware. She had a very close relationship with her sister-in-law, Sue.
Right.
And then she also almost got married to, what's his face?
Judge Otis Phillips Lord.
Yes, him.
A much older man, a man who was a contemporary of her father. Yeah, I think there's substantial. You say unsubstantiated. what's unsubstantiated is that there's no solid evidence that she had a physical relationship with either men or women, that she was drawn to men and women is substantiated through multiple sources. Mm-hmm. Her sister Sue, her sister-in-law Sue, claimed to have walked into the homestead one day and saw Emily in the lap of Otis Phillips Lord, a much older man. And Sue was scandalized by that. I don't know, that doesn't seem so scandalous to us today, but.
It depends what they're doing, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But I think from, you know, at least a homosocial, heterosocial point of view, you could say that Dickinson did a sort of manifest a bisexual erotics over the course of her life. And I think there's substantial evidence for that. How far you want to push that, that's when it gets difficult.
Yeah.
But I think most people looking at Dickinson's life and work, her correspondence, what we know about her from what others have said and what's been recorded, it's pretty hard not to to think of her as bisexual.
Cool. So you mentioned today in class she had her own, I want to say greenhouse or observatory?
Yeah, conservatory.
Conservatory, thank you.
Yeah.
So how do you think that played into her her poems and her, like, not leaving the house? Because I can understand to a point where she's like, I got everything I need here, I'm not going to leave.
Right. I think her love of flowers, there have been books written about Dickinson's greenhouse, her work with plants, and the association between flowers and poems, as you've pointed out, was very much part of the literary discourse of the 19th century. But I think that her work with flowers was consistent with her engagement with the natural world. She was very sensitive to seasonal change, to the plants that grew and died at different times of year, at the length of days, the interrelatedness of seasonal change and plant life. She had an awareness of the interconnectedness of ecosystems and was sensitive to ecological issues more broadly. And these entered her poems on a regular basis. She frequently refers to different kinds of flowers. She referred to herself as Daisy often in some poems and in her correspondence. And a daisy is a heliotrope that is that follows the course of the sun daily. And I think she associated with that attentiveness to sun, to light, to illumination. She took great pleasure in cultivating plants. And it, with her conservatory, she could control the climate in ways that enabled her to have flowers of one sort or another at any time of year. And I think one of the sources of pleasure was that she could then harvest those flowers, and she often sent them in letters to friends. She pressed flowers and would then include them in letters, sometimes with poems, when she'd talk about the flowers that she'd included. Her father constructed the conservatory for her in the 50s when she was in her 20s, I think, in order to please her, to provide her with a hobby that he knew would give her joy.
Okay, cool. And then, so here's a loaded question. What do you think people should take from Dickinson poems, or what should they learn from Dickinson?
Well, I think the first thing to learn is, one of the first things I learned is that she was deeply engaged with the world around her, mm-hmm. Despite her reclusive life. She wasn't morbid, she wasn't morose. She celebrated life in a courageous manner. One of my favorite poems begins, "A nearness to tremendousness and agony procures." And Dickinson was willing to endure. She even welcomed the agony or the pain or the stress that came with her willingness to approach difficult questions, to raise questions, to approach power as directly as she possibly could. So I think she's a poet who thinks that we all ought to act with courage and bravery every day, that we ought to be willing to confront what's new and different about each moment that we live. I think people should see her as a poet who avoids complacency, who, if there is a single sin for Emily Dickinson, that sin is bowing to complacency, wanting to live a predictable and comfortable existence. She sees that as a temptation all of us have to resist if we want to live as fully as possible every moment of our lives. And she's can be an exhausting poet because she's unrelenting in her insistence that we question the truth we receive about the major experiences of life, about education, about marriage, about God, about the natural world. We need to make up our own minds about all these things. And that doesn't mean denying the wisdom of others, but it means questioning that wisdom and finding it valid or invalid, whether it works for us or not. So those are the things I would want people to learn from Dickinson. She can be a great source of delight and laughter. She can be mean in some ways, caustic and highly critical, but that's all there. And that's another thing I'd want people to see, is just not just the range and scope of the subject matter, but the range and scope of her, the spectrum of emotional states that she's willing to engage. She wants to take us through the whole spectrum.
Okay, cool. I have one more, well, maybe a few more questions, but I have one that's itching. So I'm not sure if you're aware, but today is a day that's very special because it's part of Banned Books Week. So yeah, and with like the material Dickinson covers, has she ever been banned? Because I imagine like most really good writers have been banned, so I'm really curious, has any of her poetry or particular collection been on the banned books list?
I can't imagine that she hasn't been banned, but it's also easy to imagine that people will have never banned her, because the initial impression people have of Dickinson is that she's a really harmless writer. You know, people think of her as this sort of New England nun who lived a reclusive life and wrote about interior experience. So what's threatening about that? So I do know So the answer to your question is no. I don't know for certain that she's ever been banned. I think she probably flew under the radar, is how I would view it. I do know that her first editors, Thomas Wentworth Higginson in particular, was very careful about which of her poems he included in the first book of poetry that he and Mabel Loomis Todd published. He was worried about maintaining his reputation because he was a well-known public figure. And there were poems that he did not include in that collection that might well be worthy of banning. And I'm thinking of Wild Nights, Wild Nights.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of when I was thinking of
it. Openly sexual poem. It's interesting, that could also be read as a religious poem, I suppose. So a lot of her poems that we consider sort of radical, critical of contemporary, customary practice, convention, weren't necessarily read that way. And they're not always read that way even now. And she was conscious of that. We've talked about how 19th century women writers often had to sort of code what they were writing in order to escape the censorship of their day, in order to win the approval of editors so that they could interprint, but also say what they felt needed to be said that was critical of their culture. So women could present themselves as domestic spirits primarily, but then weave into texts about the domestic life commentaries that were highly critical of that life. So Dickinson has this kind of doubleness often in her texts. This is my letter to the world, that poem that is often viewed as a representative Dickinson poem, can be read as a spoken, delivered by a conforming 19th century woman, but it can also support a very dramatically different alternative reading that gives us an angry woman upset with the kind of confinement she's experienced.
Dickinson is just really complicated. I was for sure you were going to be like, yeah, she was banned in this particular volume because of blah, 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 blah.
No, I don't know of any.
I love the idea that you deposited that people see her as like this New England nun, because that is not the idea of Emily Dickinson I have at all.
Not me either.
I imagine if she was like in the modern world, she would be very much like a protester, maybe not out on the streets, but like online and stuff.
Right. I can see that. Yeah. I don't know how she'd respond to social media. I think she'd have to limit her exposure.
I mean, I'm thinking she would probably be Twitter famous, but she wouldn't be like, yeah, she wouldn't be Instagram famous, because I'm sorry to like get off topic, but there are people who are just famous for their Twitter and that's literally it. Like there's this guy and he's hilarious, but he just tweets like what his kids say. So his kids are like asking why, well, the best tweet was his kids were asking why everyone was congratulating him on the baby when mom was making it. And he goes, I read her the instructions. it's stupid stuff like that. So I'm like, she'd be Twitter famous.
Okay, I'll have to treat you as the authority on that.
Yeah, and then one other thing, just to state my curiosity, I know after her death, her sister found a bunch of poems and was shocked by how many poems.
Right.
So how did she, and I know Dickinson was friends with the original editors of her poetry, but how did her sister go about getting that published?
The first thing she did after she got over her amazement at the discovery was she took the poems to Susan Huntington Gilbert Dickinson, her sister-in-law. She knew that Sue and Emily were very close, and Emily and Sue sent notes back and forth. And Sue is the only correspondent verified to have influenced Swenson's writing. Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers is one of the most famous poems Dickinson wrote. And there was an exchange of letters surrounding that poem. And Dickinson rewrote a stanza in an effort to please Sue. So I'm just bringing that up because Lavinia, Emily's sister, would have naturally thought of Sue as the person to turn to when bringing the poems to the public. Sue was married to Austin and held a prominent position in Amherst society. And she, I think, wanted to publish Dickinson's poems. And the record shows that she may have included letters and other documents in a volume of Dickinson's poems, but she was not moving quickly. That is, she showed no sign of wanting to bring Dickinson before the public quickly. Probably for fear of attracting undue attention or scandal. So Lavinia had not given to Sue all of the manuscript. She'd given her some. And out of impatience with Sue, she went to Mabel Loomis Todd and asked Mabel Loomis Todd if she would be willing to work on editing. And Todd agreed, and Todd went right to work on it. And Lavinia was even impatient with her. And but Mabel Loomis Todd and later on her daughter worked many hours transcribing the poems. And they then reached out, Lavinia, to Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who collaborated with Mabel Loomis Todd on the first edition of the poems that came out in 1890 and was a huge success, went through multiple editions. So that's kind of the story.
Oh, nice. I was not expecting something so mundane as that, because with the modern world of publishing, it's usually just it's a lot of work to get published. So I was just like, oh, really? They didn't have to try harder?
No. Well, you get a person like Thomas Wentworth Higginson, you're going to get a publisher without too much trouble. He was a prominent writer and public figure. And Dickinson got to know him because of an essay he published in 1862 in the Atlantic Monthly. So he had the kind of credit to approach a press and say, here's a poet you should publish. The first book came out with Roberts Brothers, the publishers, and they had already published one of Dickinson's poems, the poem that appeared in what was called A Mask of Poets, that was given to them by Dickinson's friend, the poet and writer Helen Hunt Jackson. And Helen Hunt Jackson had learned about Dickinson from Higginson, because Dickinson had been sending Higginson poems, and he showed some of these to Helen Hunt Jackson. She got in touch with the editors at Roberts Brothers, and one of them, Thomas Niles, had approached Dickinson while she was alive and asked if he could publish a volume of her poems. And she never responded. So there was a press, Roberts Brothers was sort of primed already to bring out a volume of Dickinson's poems. So there was a sort of prehistory to her appearance in 1890. And then there's a history that comes after that, because Mabel Loomis Todd, who worked with Higginson on the first edition, had an affair with Austin Dickinson, who was Susan's husband. So there was hostility between those two families.
I can see that.
And they, each of them had some of the manuscripts, and neither of them wanted to relinquish their manuscripts to the other. And so they produced competing volumes of Dickinson's poems and letters. It wasn't until 1955 that all of the poems and manuscripts were brought together so that they could be consulted for a single volume that contained all of the known poems by Emily Dickinson. So that was 65 years after her death that we got the first complete edition of all the Dickinson poems.
I love how much drama we know about this family just because Emily's famous. It's like watching a soap opera, but they're real.
Yeah. No, it is a kind of a Peyton Place of a small town life. Small town, big town. It was the county seat, only between 3,000 and 5,000 people during Dickinson's life. But it was a center of attention. Yeah. Had a college, Amherst College.
Is that still there?
Amherst College is still there, very much there. A very prominent.
Do they have the Dickinson collection?
They have some of the manuscripts in their library, the Robert Frost Library. The other main, that's one of two main archives. Mm-hmm. The other main archive is at Harvard, the Houghton Library at Harvard University. There are other manuscripts scattered around. The Boston Public Library has some, and there are poems and letters in private collections.
Oh, that's a shame.
Some in the Beinecke Library at Yale, but most of them are at those two primary sources, archives.
Cool. Is there anything you want to add about Emily Dickinson or just anything in general?
Only that, that it, you know, if no other reason to read Dickinson, I would recommend looking at her simply out of curiosity. What is it about this work written by a reclusive 19th century woman that has so powerfully engaged today's reading public that we're seeing an outburst of attention given to this poet at this particular moment? What is it about what we're experiencing now? It could be the extraordinary uncertainty that seems to surround us as we come to terms with global warming and a degree of political uncertainty and unrest that we haven't experienced in quite a while. And combined with racial injustice, what is it about her poetry that speaks to that? Because there has to be something there. Her currency is peaking. Why?